Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of our discussion of the offense against the Miami Dolphins in week nine. Ravens road win. It's never a bad win in the NFL, but it's especially kind of a good win in a key way when you get back to winning, playing dominant primetime football. You play against a team on the road on a Thursday night, which is always a very tough scheduling component. And the Ravens got it done against this Dolphins team, as many problems as they're having. Join me to talk about this again for part two is Josh Reed. Josh, how you doing?
I'm doing a lot better, man. Now that the Ravens are doing good, I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I have so much Ravens gear that when they're not doing well, when they have long, like, losing streaks like they had, I got to dig into the bottom of my laundry basket for non-Ravens-related clothes because it got to the point where I was, like, embarrassed to wear Ravens stuff out. I didn't have a leg to stand on when it comes to arguments or anything like that. So I didn't even want people, like, to know I was associated with the Ravens for a bit, like, outside of my writing.
I guess I understand that. I don't really wear a jersey around town other than
when not jerseys, just like shirts and stuff, like shirts and hats and all that.
There you go. I do always wear a Ravens hat around town, so there's that. But anyway, this game, I don't think there's a lot to be ashamed of. The offensive line in particular played very well. Did not provide Lamar with a great opportunity set overall. We did talk about that in the first episode. Talked about a lot of things. By the way, we want to talk about our thoughts on the Jaire Alexander trade. That's in the first episode. We talked about some of the inefficiency in the first half, so it's worth going back for that. Ravens obviously now a big divisional favorite again. We gave a little look under the hood in terms of the odds, talked a little bit about Lamar and how he performed relative to his opportunity set, which was really outstanding in this game and worth we're talking. And the difference between Lamar and Tua just in terms of their how they deal with being in the pocket. Lamar's not afraid to be in the pocket for an extended time. Tua seems to be more and more afraid with each passing hundredth of a second. And that shows up in some time to throw statistics and some inaccurate throwing.
Yeah. And also another big way is like Lamar is so good at manipulating the linebackers with his eyes. Like he can like his eyes and in his posture, right? He can like turn his body one way, turn his like foot one way, or even like look a certain way and kind of look somebody off. Whereas Tua, man, that dude stares down his receivers. I mean, Roquan Smith should have had that pick. Tua, he read Tua's eyes all the way. Whereas on that Charlie Kolar big completion, you can see Lamar kind of manipulating the defense to the point where he was able to get that Kolar that little bit of separation by just having the linebacker come out of that spot because he thought he was going somewhere else. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's talk a little bit of offensive line here. I'll start at with Ronnie Stanley, but please, I want you to lead this, kind of ask the questions as we go through this. Josh, that always, I think, seems to work a little better. But Stanley, a solid game in this one. I don't have him rated as high as PFF. In each of the last 2 weeks, there's been some pressures he's allowed by my definitions that are not pressures by PFF definitions. And specifically, they're cone intrusions, where the quarterback and his feet just cannot be comfortable because Stanley has let the pass rusher get too close. So he did have a solid game. It was a C- as I scored it. He left after 48 snaps. So we had the last drive, that 10-minute drive, or not the 10-minute drive, the 6-minute drive. Noteboom came in and was in there. It was actually 10 plays he was in, but two of them were kneels. So those don't count for this. Stanley gave up 3.5 pressures. He did miss 6 blocks as well. He looked good in terms of what play-by-play, having normal amount of strength, he seemed to be good. It didn't seem like he's having the ankle problems again in this game. There didn't seem to be, getting caught on an ankle and all of a sudden he's going out and he's moving his ankle abnormally. But he also was getting backed up a few times and had some problems with, I think it was mostly Chubb on his side, not Phillips. Yeah. So,
I think it was good to kind of get him out late in that game, just because like given his history, like the last thing you need is your franchise left tackle get rolled up on a 6-minute drive trying to close out a game when all you just need to do is kind of sit on the ball and run out of clock. So I did like they got him off the field on that one. As far as his performance, it's definitely not the Ronnie Stanley we saw last year, the resurgent Ronnie Stanley. Actually, he has dealt with some injuries this season, but like I said. Having Lamar kind of mitigates a lot of that stuff. But I'm kind of segue into the guy playing next to him. How did Andrew Voorhees do in this one?
Yeah, so good game for Voorhees. And Voorhees had, by the way, a pretty darn good string of games. If you're thinking, oh boy, we got to get Kevin Zeitler on our place voice, that would be frankly ridiculous at this point. I mean, absolutely absurd at this point. There's so many reasons why Voorhees should be kept in at left guard. If you want to make the claim, go ahead and make it for Falele. I think it's probably the wrong decision also, but it's a terrible decision to replace Voorhees. Voorhees has now had five Bs in the last six games. He started off terrible, just an awful two-game start to the season, which was worse than any two consecutive games that Falele had last year. It was that bad. And Falele was really bad for the first 14 weeks before he turned it around. Well, Voorhees has played 5 out of 6 really good games. Now, he did have a D against Houston, so that wasn't a particularly good game. But the rest of the time, he's been a B or B minus and just very solid. And this game, he had two missed blocks and one pressure allowed and one quarterback hit allowed. So not ideal, obviously, any negative event you give up, but that works out to an 83 in terms of the raw score. With a small adjustment, he's still in the B range. It would have been a B minus, I think. 83 is a B minus. So he got up to a B with a very small adjustment. Three blocks in level two. Now, here's the big thing. He made all six of his pulls. And he's not done that for a couple consecutive weeks. I'm trying to see if I've got the last week's scoring here.
He did pretty good against the Rams, too. I remember that.
Yeah. I think he might have had 5 out of 5 against the Rams. And he might have at least been close to perfect against the Bears as well. This is really a big deal. The Ravens don't have a mobile guard, and it seems like they might have hit again in terms of being able to teach a guy some mobility beyond his natural athleticism. They can't do that with Falele. I mean, he does not have the basic tools to pull particularly effectively, and particular on some passing situations. Sometimes you ask a player to pull and make a pocket. After that, that's really a tough ask of Falele. And Voorhees is much more able to do it physically, and what I've seen from in that respect is probably as impressive as some of the improvements in pass blocking that he's had.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's just this. He was always a guy that just needed to play. You know, like I really feel like had an ankle injury last year, and McCary come in, he definitely would have been on a trajectory to kind of be for along his development. That was his first year back from his ACL, and now he's more than like what 2 years removed from that, almost 2 years removed from that now. So now he has all that functional strength back in his knee, the mobility, and then he's getting more experience. You know, we're going into week 10 now after this game. So just, he was a guy that, you know, he got plenty of playing time at USC, don't get me wrong, but having all that time on task at this level really kind of helps expedite offensive lineman's development as far as getting used to what kind of defensive lineman you're going to be going up against, their kind of strength, getting that grown man strength of your own back.
Right. We're going to – I'm just afraid we're going to get a cautionary tale again with the Emory Jones situation relative to the Voorhees situation. Now, Voorhees, seventh-round pick, it's easier to kind of push this on the player. But Emory Jones, also a guy who got injured – basically, they knew he was hurt when they drafted him, apparently. But then he had to get surgery, and he didn't even start pass blocking until very recently. He's now had to be activated to the roster because they jumped the gun on adding him to the practice routine that opened the 3-week window. Mm-hmm. Him coming off
the non-football injury list. Yeah,
and I still struggle with the notion. First of all, I don't think he'll play effectively this year. I don't think he'll play this year, but I don't think he'll play effectively this year. If he did, if he was forced into action because that's all the Ravens got, I think Cleveland might be first for starters. And then if they put in Jones at some point, I don't think he'll be effective would be my guess. He needs ramp time. And it's not that it would be a terrible thing for him to get, you know, some 100 snaps this year if you could get it to fail forward into 26. But hey, the Ravens, I don't know. I mean, they need the best possible guard play they can have. The guys they've got are just hanging on, you know, at a league average level right now. But Voorhees is playing a little bit better than that right now. Falele is playing right at the, you know, a league average level. He's above average pass blocker, very much a below average run blocker. I don't know, you know, that they can afford to take a chance with Emory Jones and move him out there. I mean, I don't see him as being good as a rookie. Most rookies are not, by the way. It's just a standard rule that it generally takes time to get better at being an NFL offensive lineman. And the guys you face in the NFL are a hell of a lot better than the guys you face in college. So you may have seen the tweet recently about who would win a game between Ohio State,
Ohio State and the Jets. Jets or the Browns or whatever, something like that, right?
Yeah. I think it was the Jets. I think so. And you know, somebody said, you know, the Jets minus 45 or something. and I think they're probably about right.
But, you know, yeah, when I was in high school, they did the same thing because that was like during the height of the Alabama Nick Saban dynasty when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. So this is like you had like Trent Richardson, AJ McCarron, those kind of teams, and they were saying could the Alabama beat the Browns, because I think that was one of the years or the Lions, because that was one of the years the Lions were like 0-16 or something like that, or the Browns only won like two games. So I was like, dude, the Browns were curb stomp Alabama. You're talking about a bunch of grown-ass men with families to feed going against a bunch of 18, 19, 20-year-olds.
A.J. McCarron is already done with football now. I still got my A.J. McCarron signed ball, and any hope I had of appreciation of value on that will now be tied to his political career. So he's apparently running for lieutenant governor, I think, of Kentucky. What? And he may be
for the Battlehawks no more?
I think he may actually have a political career in front of him, that he'd be a guy who could he always wore that weird bow tie, and so he may be a guy who could move up a couple of levels that way and be the run for governor and then maybe be the senator or even run for president someday. But he's certainly a good, starting as a pro athlete and getting your start that way, worked for Jack Kemp, but worked for a lot of other players. Oh, yeah. So
he should go to Alabama. He'd win for sure. If he'd run in Alabama,
I may have the state wrong. I thought it was Kentucky that he was running for. You could look it up. If A.J. McCarron, lieutenant governor, and you'll probably see where he's running for. But anyway, if that ball is to become valuable someday, it will be because he gets the senator or maybe even makes a presidential run at some point. I'm sure you're really concerned about that. You know, but the point I'm making is that A.J. McCarron couldn't even play in the NFL. He couldn't even get on the field in the NFL with Cincinnati and, being a backup quarterback. He's probably got, six career starts or something, maybe not even that. And they're talking about, of course, A.J. McCarron is one of the centerpieces to Alabama, who's going to beat an NFL team. Okay. All right. Let's keep going here. Let's talk Tyler Linderbaum. Now, Tyler Linderbaum had been having a very, very, very tough season until last week, where he turned in his really first big game where he had an A-. This week, an A. Again, a new best for the season for him. Didn't allow any negative events. Had three missed blocks. The Dolphins' interior rushers are nothing special. That's for certain. They don't have a really dominant guy in terms of size. They lack that guy.
They miss Campbell for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and they've had other guys over the years.
Christian Wilkins.
That's one thing. Yeah. So anyway, half a pressure he gave up against Chicago. Nothing against Miami. Got 51 out of 54 points. It's .94. Didn't have a lot of mobility blocks in this game. The Ravens just didn't release him to level two too much. Some of that's a matter of, are they running zone or gap? But he had two level two blocks and one pull successfully. And that's about all I have to say about that game. It's just an outstanding game. It's great to see him turn it around. And he's playing for his next contract right now in a very big way. And I think there's a lot of incredibly irresponsible talk early in the season about how the guard play was pulling him down. The play of the guards was pulling his play down. That is complete crapola. I mean, I'll just tell you, Linderbaum was the worst pass blocker of the three of them for the first 7 weeks of this season until the Chicago game. Okay. And now all of a sudden he's turned it on and he's started blocking himself. It's not the guard play around him. It was him in terms of, and it might still be him, in terms of facing some bigger interior defenders as the season goes on.
Yeah. I mean, luckily for them, I mean, okay, I guess they got Quinnen Williams coming up, but like, there aren't too many daunting defensive tackles. I mean, Cam Hayward isn't having a great season right now. Nobody on the Steelers defense has a great season right now. But like I said, they went through a really quite the gauntlet to open the season as far as interior guys go. You know, Ed Oliver and then who did they have a week two? Then the freaking the Browns. I mean, their defensive front has been killing it all season. So part of that is high level competition. But then again, if you want to get paid the big bucks, man, you got to play your best against the big dogs.
Right. So anyway, good start on getting himself back, and maybe this is the impetus to get him signed here again in Baltimore at this point. And you know, if he can put together a few good games, help the Ravens, you know, make a little run here, I think that probably slightly improves his chances. I kind of had the feeling that Lindebaum was pricing himself out of town, not necessarily because of any actual evidence I have, by the way. I don't have anything. I don't think Tyler Linderbaum's ever said publicly what he wants in terms of money. Patrick Queen would say it on Twitter that he's, oh, no, I'm getting more than 4 years and $68 million with the, you know, on my next contract. And then he signs with the Steelers for 3 for $41 million kind of thing. Yeah. It just sets you up to look stupid if you do that kind of thing. So in Linderbaum's case, much too smart a player and too smart a human, frankly, to do that kind of thing. But I think he's, you know, he should be at each moment reassessing exactly where he is relative to the market. And he should have good advice in terms of that. And these last two games have clearly helped him. I still don't think he's going to get Creed Humphrey money, but he might get a
Cam Jurgens money. I think he'll get it somewhere around there. He might not top Jurgens, but I think he'll definitely be kind of like somewhere in that neighborhood. And every time he's asked about it at podium, he's always like kind of given the I won't say coach speak answer. He's not a coach, but he's always going, yeah, I'll let my agent handle that kind of thing. Him and Kyle Hamilton, same thing, and it worked for Kyle Hamilton, but Kyle Hamilton's Kyle Hamilton.
Yeah, that's the way you do it though, and you know. There's a whole bunch of things you shouldn't say. There should be a handbook on what you shouldn't say, but it's easier to just know what you should say, which is just a, look, I'm here. I love playing football with this Grunfish guys. I'd love to stay here if it works out. I'm letting my agent handle the business side of my career. That's not me. And Lamar Jackson, he can't do that because he doesn't have an agent. Okay, that's kind of an unfortunate circumstance of the situation. But Tyler Linderbaum sure can. And there's other players who are not as good at doing it, and they get up at the podium and they make an ass of themselves. And I, you know, one of them, unfortunately, this offseason, I thought that Kyle Van Noy made it very clear how unhappy he was that he didn't have a new contract from the Ravens during one time at the podium. You know, in his case, he was a little bit deflective about the thing. You know, he said, I'm here. You know, I think I'm more valuable. I think I'm valuable. I think I should have a new contract effectively. He didn't say it in exactly those words. Then you go back a number of years, Rafael Palmeiro talked about how, you know, the Orioles didn't make him a good offer because Texas, who made him the other offer, had no state income tax. And so his salary was worth 5% more there, or 7.5% more, whatever it was for the state income tax of Maryland. And that's not the court of public opinion is not where you want to have that discussion over the $2.5 million on the margin that might be more you would make. Or the $1.5 million. It's just not the right place to a bunch of guys who are making $50,000 a year.
I'm about to say the guys in his bar don't want to hear that shit. but yeah, we can move on to the guy that everybody wants to talk about when it comes to Ravens offensive line, whether that most of the time in the negative light. But talk to me about Daniel Falele. How did he grade out in your system?
So, you know, this is weird because I kind of expected it to be worse. It looked terrible again on TV. And it always does. You know, it doesn't look like he has normal kind of movement skills for a guard, and doesn't really. But he makes up for it in some other ways. He didn't allow a penalty. He didn't have a penalty in this game. He didn't allow a quarterback hit or a sack. He did allow a shared pressure with Stanley. He also had a shared penetration that he allowed on a run play. And that was at the goal line when they lost a yard. So I think it was third and one. They lost a yard to make it fourth and two. Mm-hmm. I think that was the play.
Yeah,
Falele actually did something that was really bad, and if he'd gotten flagged, it would have been, you know, he would have had the much lower grade that everybody else seems to want from Falele every week. But he went low on a guy who was engaged with Rosengarten, and that could have been a chop block very easily if it had been seen.
Yeah, I remember.
And then, to make matters worse, there was another guy, I think number 25, came through that hole and got to the runner. So it was a case of, not only did he maybe choose the wrong guy, or maybe that was the design of the play that he was supposed to block that guy, but he blocked him wrong if he did. And he also missed an opportunity to block a different player who he really would have helped Henry potentially get the yard and the touchdown flow on.
Yeah. I think the worst thing about Falele, man, is just like, it seems like I've never seen somebody. So it's jarring when somebody that big looks lost. a lot of the time. You know, like it's one thing if you're looking for work. Another thing if you like completely whiff on a block or it just and then it's already like people already have their eyes fixated on you. And it seems like whenever he's kind of on an island there, like people like I love that one guy on Twitter, the Falala guy. It's Falala, Falala. Yeah. That guy cracks me up. But yeah, man, when you're offensive line, man, like if they're calling your name. It usually means it's a bad thing, and it's like that. I kind of feel for the guy just because he's trying to make a name for himself in the league and live out his dreams. And every week he's something like the one or two mistakes he makes in a game are going viral, and people are calling for his head.
Well, that's exactly what's happening, though. I mean, he's a fairly effective pass blocker. In fact, PFF has a similar kind of a pegging on him as I do. He's the 13th best guard pass blocking in the league this year out of. I want to say it's like 57 players who played half the snaps at guard. And that's outrageously good. I mean, that's much better than anybody I think would give him credit for. But I think it's reasonable. He's just very indecisive. Run blocking is far less important than pass blocking. I think I weighed it correctly. PFF grades it exactly the opposite way. If PFF made an offensive plus slugging percentage number, they would make it offensive on-base percentage plus three times slugging percentage. And it would give you completely the wrong idea of who's a really valuable hitter. But they go the opposite way, and they have their reasons for it. They think it creates more differentiation among the players at the position. But it doesn't differentiate value correctly. That's the problem with it. And, you know, Falele is just – he's been a lot better than that. And this wasn't a good game. I mean, it was a C game. It was just an average game. And a lot of that was accumulated late in the game when the game was, you know, in hand on that final drive. Most of the offensive linemen, they didn't quite make every block on that drive. We'll just look at it real quickly here. But they only had three zeros on that. Well, two of them were Falele getting pancaked on that final drive. But he made six of his eight blocks on that drive. So I guess it didn't really help him that much overall in terms of the game. But, you know, there's overstatement abounds with regard to Daniel Falele. Everybody feels like they have to either present a 10-play every failure packet of information about Falele, and they don't try and look at the good plays either. They don't try and look at the fact that, you know, play after play, he's basically patrolling his area as a pass blocker and doing a pretty damn good job.
Ken, that doesn't generate likes and views, man.
Yeah, there you go.
People want to see the low lights. They want to see people at their lowest so they can kick them while they're down. They don't want to see like you could have a 35 second low light reel and a 5 minute highlight reel, but I guarantee you that low light reel will gain more traction on social media than that highlight reel will.
It certainly upset fans. And fans, you know, fans of a losing team in particular have no tolerance for praising of individual players in typical, especially controversial individual players. Mm-hmm. The people who are, you know, who are pretty okay with Falele, or they, you know, they follow my writing, or they look at it themselves and they say, you know, a couple plays here, a couple plays there, but, you know, I can't say it really cost the Ravens a lot. They're not willing to come out of the woodwork and try and re-educate the masses on their views on Falele. It's not worth their time.
No, nobody wants to die on that sword or that hill.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, I don't think it's likely that Daniel will be back in Baltimore, but I could see it. I think the Ravens certainly are short on the offensive line, generally speaking. I don't think it's impossible that they'd re-sign him, and they'd probably want to re-sign him for a bargain rate. I think it might be possible that they could get it. But then when you look at places that are scoring multiple linemen and you really look at pass and run blocking separately, you realize Falele is pretty good in this league, relatively speaking. I mean, replacing Falele with Kevin Zeitler right now wouldn't be a step up in value and step up in play. But more than that, or if it was, it'd be a slight one. More than that, you'd kill off any compensatory value you could get from Falele.
I think Falele is going to land in one of two spots. Neither one is going to be in Baltimore. I think he's either destined to be a Charger or an Eagle. I mean,
not a Jets player because they took John Simpson off our hands.
They did, but I feel like the Jets are kind of entering this new regime where like they don't want to be the Ravens Northeast anymore. I think he's going to be either Ravens West or an Eagle. He like I said, he was kind of drafted to be a right tackle in Greg Roman's scheme. Of course, they're all set at tackle over there in Los Angeles, but if they still want him to play guard or even just as offensive line depth, he's a guy who's had well over 20 starts at this point in his career now. So yeah, I think he's going to be a Charger or an Eagle.
Okay. All right. That certainly could make sense in terms of the size they like. Anyway, a C for Falele in this game.
Yeah, round us out, Ken, with how'd Roger Rosengarten do in this one?
Outstanding game from Rosengarten. Played 54 plays, made 50 blocks, missed four, didn't have a single negative event. So very similar to the game that Linderbaum had. In some ways, it was better. He had four level two blocks, and he had three different highlight combination blocks. So this game, Linderbaum didn't have any, just happened to work out that way. Linderbaum usually is a pretty good generator of highlight blocks in a typical game because he makes a lot of combination blocks. Rosengarten this year he's shown pretty darn good mobility, frankly, getting to level two, making blocks, knowing what he's doing there in terms of getting people angled up. And he certainly wasn't bothered in this game by the fact that he wasn't getting particularly high quality help blocks from Falele. So this is a fine performance. He's on a pretty good track here. And I think I'd probably have to say, let me see where they stand for the year. He's a 73 plus about maybe 0.06 on average at tackle so far this year. So he's been like a C plus player at tackle. And that is very similar to some of the other better players. So Linderbaum is probably a high C right now. Stanley is lower than that. I think he's probably the best, at basically a C plus level for the year right now. He's probably the best Ravens lineman in terms of grading right now. That doesn't mean I don't believe that Linderbaum will come back and be effective down the stretch, but I wouldn't have said the same thing 2 weeks ago. I would not have.
No, I was really concerned. Yeah, it was looking rough for Rosengarten, man. I definitely thought he was going to kind of pick up on that where he left off as far as his trajectory last year. Just because, I mean, I know progress is never linear, right? But when it comes to offensive linemen, the more time they have on task, and you thought, especially with the whole offseason, he's going from year one to year two, and that's usually where guys, especially offensive linemen, kind of get their grown men strength. And he was a guy that was always kind of slight coming out of Washington anyways. And, like Odafe Owe, like Nate Wiggins, he was one of those guys that packed on some pounds of muscle this offseason. So I thought, he was going to kind of pick up where he left off. But it's good to see him kind of running out into shape now.
Yeah. Now, he's had the exact same grades, by the way, Linderbaum has the last 2 weeks, A minus and an A, which is – that's unusual, but also very good that he's playing with some consistency. Anyway, that takes us through the offensive line. We get to this part of the show. We always want to talk about individual skill position players. Why don't you start us off? Who would you like to talk about?
I'll talk about Derrick Henry. He's a guy that third straight game. No, he didn't kind of over 100 yards rushing, but more so than the rushing yards, it was just like the kind of yards he was picking up. More positive yards than negative yards. Not always getting stuff at the line of scrimmage. I mean, it was a slog for him. Like the first part of this season, like there was too many times where he was getting met in the backfield time after time, and he seems like so hell bent on not getting stuff in the backfield that like there are times where he's like literally leaping into the backs of his offensive lineman just to make sure he's getting positive gains so that this team can stay in a positive game script and not have to face a third. Even if you get 3 yards, third and seven is more manageable than third and 10. Cause there are times where guys are getting tackled 3 yards short of the line of the line of the game, man, if we would have just got a few yards on that first, second down. I'd like to still see us run the ball better with Derrick Henry at the goal line. That's just been something that was kind of like easy money last year, and it's just kind of like pulling teeth again this year. Like after that after the Lola Gilman turnover and he had that first run where he basically almost scored a touchdown, I'm like, okay, they're gonna punch Derek on the next play or two plays. Like honestly, I wouldn't even mind if they did more like direct snap like stuff to Derek Henry right there just so he could just like Cam Newton that shit and just run it right up the middle,
Yeah, I personally hate the direct snap. It takes away the misdirection component of the Ravens offense that is so valuable, which is the mesh point between Jackson and Henry. So if you have a direct snap, you're basically giving that up. If you're going to do something else like throw out of it or pitch back to Jackson out of it where he could throw a pass from it, then I got no problem with it. But you better have something else other than a direct run that you can go to from that starting position, because it takes one of your most important offensive player out of the play effectively.
Yeah, I just mean from like inside to like the 1 to 2 yard line, like if like, you know, just right there, not tush push, but just like bam, you know, how are you going to stop the locomotive from getting in there unless you get excellent penetration, which has happened against this offensive line. So,
all right, well, fair enough. I like Henry's game. He's on pace for 1,336 yards now for the year. Probably won't get there, but if he did, I think we got to look at this through the prism of what did you really expect from Derrick Henry the year after he had the greatest year for any running back in the 21st century. At least by DVOA standards, that's true. I don't know what anybody really expected. Did they expect, well, nothing? If he ran for 1,900 last year, he should run for 2,000 this year. Well, you know, he's a 31-year-old running back. You know, this is not, it's not a reasonable expectation. He's going to make some huge step forward. And obviously he's dealt with Lamar being hurt as a big part that the
Ricard too.
I'm sorry, say again.
I'll say Ricard being out.
Ricard too. And the defense not playing well. And when the defense is not playing well, the Ravens don't have the leads. They're not generating the good opportunities for him to both close out games and pick up yards that way. And the opposing defense is more fresh under those circumstances. That's definitely been the case this year with the few plays the Ravens offense has run. And, you know, it's just they need to spend, that offense needs to spend more time on the football field to maximize who Derrick Henry is. It wasn't reasonable. And as he's got a 53% success rate. That's a lot better than his career rate in Tennessee, which was only 49%. It's not as good as it was last year, but I wouldn't expect it to, because that number was historic. It was the best. It was better than any previous season. It happened that Bijan Robinson also had a year that was basically 100% as good, but it was better than any previous season for anybody who had 300 carries or more.
Yeah, I honestly feel like the stars kind of aligned for Derrick Henry last year. First time playing with, the most dynamic, then if you know, dual third quarterback in NFL history, offensive line kind of gelled together after a rough start. And then you had Patrick Ricard leading the way. And, you know, like kind of similar with Saquon Barkley, you know, those explosive runs that he was getting last year, they're just not coming as easily this year. You know, opposing teams see that, like, oh man, Derrick Henry and Ravens offense is different than Derrick Henry and the Tennessee offense. You know, like Saquon Barkley and the Eagles offense is different than Saquon Barkley and the Giants offense. So like, it was, and this year it's been a mixture of offensive line plays kind of been inconsistent. You haven't had your star dual threat quarterback at you know, for a chunk of the season, and then you also hasn't had one of your best lead blockers for the up until Sunday. So yeah,
no, it's certainly been a tough season. And when you're projecting these things, and I don't care what you're projecting, if you're projecting yards for Lamar.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
For Rashad Bateman, if you're predicting passing yards for Lamar, if you're predicting, try not to just work with what are the single optimal circumstances and everybody stays healthy and nothing goes wrong and this and that. Because I can tell you, I had a guy, a friend of mine at work used to say, if nothing changes, there's going to be a revolution.
Everything changes.
I can tell you that's 100% a worthless freaking comment, because there will be, the one thing I can guarantee you is there will be change. And if there isn't a revolution, you certainly can always point back to the fact that there was change. And oh, you know, that made my prediction invalid. Yeah.
The mere fact that the Ravens were the healthiest team per DVOA since like 2016, 2017 Falcons, that told us everything that regression was coming like a motherfucker, man. I just didn't think it was coming.
Yeah, it's something where obviously people are not completely hip to that. Let's talk about Rashad Bateman a little bit, because tough game for him. We talked about him a little bit in the first episode. Was nice to see him get the touchdown catch late in the game, obviously wide open in the end zone there, but also got held on a play, said something he shouldn't have to the official. You mentioned it, got caught on the camera. I actually didn't see it on the TV copy as we were running through the offense. But anyway, take your word for it. And obviously something was said for him to get a flag under those circumstances. Not a good game for him in those terms. And he did happen to run through a defensive holding call by, who's the guy, number 23, Jack Jones.
Yeah,
that's right. So, yeah. You know, on the touchdown catch at the end of the game, you really do need the Dolphins roster to keep track of their corners and their defensive backs at this point. The only guy, you know, you'd recognize is Minka and maybe Douglas too.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of teams right now though, man. I mean, like Lions, they were able to do what they did against the Bucks, which one of the better defensive performances I've seen of this season. You know, with freaking the Ravens outcast, they had Arthur Mollett out there, and who's the other guy they had from Ravens?
Arthur Mollett is playing for the Lions now.
Yeah, Arthur Mollett was out there. Oh, Rocky Sin was out there balling for them in that Monday night game against the.
I remember that.
Okay. Yeah. Arthur Millett and Rocky Sin were out there getting interceptions and PBUs for the Detroit Lions on a Monday night a couple weeks ago. And so like I said, a lot of secondaries are hurt right now, but to me, that's all the more reason to take advantage of it. You know, I don't feel like the Ravens should be criticized for taking advantage of the same thing that the Texans did against the Ravens a few weeks ago. So
let me ask you this. What would be your hope for Bateman for the rest of this season? Whether you want to be qualitative or quantitative about it, what would you hope?
I'd like to see him get back on the same page with Lamar in more of a way that they were last year, especially on downfield passes. I mean, like their deep connection last year was I wouldn't say bar none, but it was such a breath of fresh air for this offense. You know, he's not the fastest guy, but his ability to make plays downfield and get behind defenses and kind of open it up a little bit more for the tight ends and for Zay to work underneath. I think having an element back in this offense would be great. Go ahead.
I just want to say it's absolutely critical that Lamar and Bateman get back on the same page, because they're two of the players that are going to be together for a long time. We don't know about Likely. He might be gone. We know that Andrews probably won't be around by the time Bateman is still playing with the Ravens a few years from now. It could happen, but I think it's unlikely. And he's not signed right now. We have no idea if Kolar is going to be a Raven anymore. Zay Flowers could be gone in 2 years. So, you know, we're at a point right now where Bateman is the one guy who's going to be a constant. Lamar better be able to play with him for a few more years. There'll be new weapons that'll come along, but Bateman is a very key player. To me, I'd like him to see him. I care less about targets at this point. I'd like to see about 4 targets per game, but I don't need to see 6 or 7 targets per game, because that was never realistic. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to see about 4 targets per game where he's back to 9 to 9.5 yards per target. That's what I say. That's not a 36, 38 expected yards per game. It's not a big ask in that respect, but it'd be a good per play efficiency on his targets.
Yeah, that'd be great too. Oh, next player. Oh, okay. Talk about Mr. Charlie Kolar, man. I really feel like this guy has the makings of being the next Josh Oliver, as far as a guy who's kind of flying under the radar, emerging. It went from, you know, primary pass catching tight end in college to emerge as one of the better blocking tight ends, and it's kind of that underrated pass catcher. It's funny, somebody who went from a prolific pass catcher, and I remember us talking about Charlie Kolar in that draft show that we did four years ago now. Yeah, and I just remember this guy was like you know, a prolific receiver coming out of Iowa State, and now he's kind of being an underrated pass catcher with the Ravens at this point in his career. But just like the stuff that he's been able to do, I mean, you're not gonna credit a guy for getting, you know, wide ass open and getting forgotten defense, but just, you know, for making that catch, making the catch he did over the middle, and then his blocking continually to be a weapon for this team. I love Charlie Kolar, man.
Yeah, I did a little bit of everything in this game, obviously. Good, you know, good as a blocker. His targets per game are up from where they were last year. Certainly is not a guy who's had, look at what he's had on a per game basis here. So Kolar has had 0-0, 3-0, 1-1, 1-2 so far this year. So he's had 8 targets in 8 games. And he said, you know, caught 6 of those balls and he's averaging over 8 yards per catch. This was the big one this game, the 20-yard throw to him. And then I guess it was about a 3-yard TD and a 20-yard first down on the last drive, I think it was. So, you know, good game for him. Nice to see him get a nice, easy pitch and catch kind of touchdown from Lamar. And I thought he's really deserved. He's blocked well, and he's pass blocked and done some run blocking both effectively. And he's a guy I think the Ravens would really love to have around again. And he's also the kind of contract, if they re-sign him, the reaction to it, I'm afraid, is going to be similar to the Nick Boyle signing a few years ago, where people vomit up vitriol because the guy's not a hard target.
I was going to say, although I feel like Charlie Cole, if he were to be re-signed, especially if he were to get re-signed before Likely or Andrews, or instead of one of those two guys, I think he's more of a fan favorite as far as like, than Nick Boyle was. Like, nobody really cared, the casual fan or the avid fan, they didn't really too much appreciate what Nick Boyle brought to the table as a blocker, although they love seeing the Ravens run the ball. But I feel like because of Charlie's color, like, kind of gregarious personality, that people are more like receptive and likable towards him.
Yeah, he is kind of a funny guy. He really, really tries hard to be funny at the microphone, which sometimes comes off a little weird. But he's a legitimately funny guy, and I think he's likable. I just think sometimes it comes off a little weird how funny he's trying to be.
Agreed.
All right. So you said Charlie Kolar. Let me go on. Quiet game from Hopkins. I guess it's not really worth talking about too much. They did throw him one ball. I guess it was overthrown.
Yeah, 3rd and 7, deep down the right sideline, overshot him. I mean, but Hopkins is not the kind of person who's going to really come up clutch in games like this. He's the guy that's going to make that clutch 3rd and 7 play when games are much tighter than they were late in this game. So, I mean, I really appreciate the role that Hopkins is playing on this team. I'd like to see him get a little bit more involved, not just, you know, to appease him, but just so that they can have more time on task as far as concrete proof of concept, right? Like, you know, so that, like, it's one thing to hit those back shoulders in practice and occasionally, every other game. But, like, they were, like, earlier in the season, I didn't think that was going to be sustainable, him getting, you know, those big contested catches down the sideline every game, like he was against the Bills, then against the Browns. But just seeing him get at least a couple targets a game, more so than just the low percentage down the field back shoulder things, I'd like to see that a little more going
forward. Yeah, he's still among the leaders in the NFL in terms of yards per target. He's at almost 13 yards per target right now. I don't know how many guys are ahead of that. He's only got 15 targets now, so it's not a lot, but he's having a year that's very similar for the full year to what Tylan Wallace did last year. Mm-hmm. So that was really exceptional in terms of a per target basis. And Hopkins has done it without separation, which means, you know, he basically can dictate single coverage at any time. The Ravens have too many weapons for any kind of gimmick defense to be played on Hopkins. You can play zone against the Ravens. You can do that, of course. That'll take away some of what Hopkins can do. But any time that you're in a man situation on 3rd and 7, 3rd and 8, and they want to run anything towards the sideline or whatever, it's very hard to get two men in coverage of Hopkins with all the other weapons the Ravens present. And he's a mismatch almost against any cornerback in man play. I'm not saying mismatch is probably right or wrong. He's a lot more likely to make an impactful play when covered than just about any other receiver out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that veteran savvy, man. He knows how to extend that arm ever so slightly to not get the OPI, but still make it seem like he's fighting for the ball. Because you see a lot of times guys will get handsy with him too. So he'll know, all right, if this guy's arm is locked out on me, that means I can maybe get away with a little bit of a shove here, like he did against in that Bears game. Like, yeah, is it OPI? Maybe, but the guy that had his hands on him too. So you had two guys jostling for the ball. You know, offensive guy is usually not going to get that OPI there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. All right, how about we move on? We take a couple of mailbag questions here because we have a few people who've submitted some things. Let's go. We start with Angelov85. Angelov, I've got two questions for you. The first one, with Ricard coming back and the run blocking looking better, should we trade for a guard? Also, well, let's start with that. Should we trade for a guard? Where are you on that?
It's really hard when it comes to offensive linemen is dropping somebody into an already established lineup. You know, like offensive line, a lot of it's about chemistry, sometimes even more than talent, because you'll have a lot of talented blockers, right? But if those guys don't have time on task and cohesion and communication, you know, like you'll have guys like literally mid play. What's the kid? Oh, yeah, I gotta block him, right? And so, like, I think that's why I was never opposed to the Kevin Zeitler thing, just because he's familiar with the system, you know? So, like, but having to teach somebody who's not even familiar with the playbook and then expect them to learn it on the fly and be plopped right into this starting lineup, I'm not a big proponent of that. It's really about relationships and offensive line.
So, in terms of continuity, I don't disagree with you. And the Ravens have you know, had a pretty good line the last couple of years, largely because of continuity, I'd say over talent in a lot of ways. The other thing I just say is it's really hard for the Ravens to find roster spots right now at guard. It would be a lot easier to say, yeah, they should trade for a guard if they had kept Jones on NFI the whole year. And I think that was the right play. Okay. I don't think we're going to get valuable play out of him this year, which means effectively we're losing a year. What it probably means is they couldn't come to any kind of financial agreement with Jones to make it worth his while to sit out for the entire year. So, you know, it is what it is. The Ravens have to play by these rules, obviously, but if they could have the Voorhees treatment of Emory Jones, that would be a lot better situation. I didn't just call him Chris Jones, did I?
No, he said
Henry
Jones.
All right. Angelov has a couple more questions here. The next one, also regarding Lamar and practice status, was the league more concerned with betting or player health? I'll start with that one. I think the league is concerned with both. I don't think they want competitive advantages gained from injury reports that are not reflecting accurately whether a player is going to play. And the worst kind of injury report is probably one where you say a player is going to play and then he doesn't. And if you're talking about the gambling thing, I think that the league wants to have an agnostic view of gambling. I mean, they want it to be not a consideration in how they run their league, but it already is a big consideration. They changed the league from being an entertainment game into being an entertainment game because of their affiliation with gambling. They basically said, you're watching something that is entertainment. It's not necessarily for competition. And what they're doing is they're saying that this is like pro wrestling. If you bet on it, caveat emptor. You're taking your chances on this. But if you can bet on stupid WWE stuff too, right? I mean, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I'll give my thoughts on it, man. Honestly, I don't think it was from any sort of competitive, because my thing is, when you listen to these opposing coaches, like from opposing teams, they're preparing for Lamar anyways. Like if there's a 1% chance that he could play in this game, they're preparing for it. So like to try to think that the Ravens are trying to pull a wool over somebody's head and trying to do some little funny business, like, will they play, might he not play? Opposing teams, they don't look at your injury report and be like, oh yeah, okay, that guy's limited. They assume that all your best players are going to be out there until they're not. So I don't think that it was had anything to do with kind of trying to deceive the Bears or anything like that. It definitely, to me, 100%, almost 100% about the betting aspect, especially on the heels of that whole NBA scandal thing and the fact that the line moved from when Lamar Jackson, and thankfully Huntley still covered. So the people who put their money down on it still got their money, right? For the Ravens still covered, but the fact that line moved so dramatically based on that one player. But whenever you have quarterbacks like a Mahomes, like a Jackson, I even saw that I forgot what podcast I'm listening to. They said like the two most dramatic things when it comes to like lines moving are like kicker status and quarterback status. Like if you have a kicker that, you know, it's a little iffy and that might, you know, move the line a little bit. Or we have a star quarterback that's out, it's going to move it a lot. So yeah. I definitely think it's more to do with the gambling thing than it had to do with any kind of competitive advantage the Ravens are trying to gain.
Right. Well, it made the point that even before, and Jeremy Kahn was on the show last week and talked about Yeah, the NFL can talk about not being in bed with gambling, or they can just admit that they are, but they were in bed with gambling a long time before, because the popularity of the sport is largely gambling based. So mm-hmm. baseball has its own contingent of nerds and wackos who watch the sport, including me, that enjoy it for other reasons. But, you know, basketball has its own type of fans who like a certain type of thing in sports. Hockey fans, listen to hockey podcasts. They are insane. You know, some of the people who are fans of that sport. Football fans, I mean, one of the things they really love is to gamble on what is now the national pastime. And it's you know, it's part of what it is. It's part of what made the NFL so popular. So the NFL can't just disavow any knowledge of it. They have to treat it reasonably, whether or not they're actually owning pieces of DraftKings or FanDuel or whatever they own now.
Yeah, I have a cousin that anytime you probably run into this too. Anytime you do something football related, comes football season, you got a million one people asking you for like, hey, who should I play this week? You think Lamar's going to get 2 touchdowns this week? I'm putting $300 on there. You bring that, you know, I'm like, dude, don't like, I'm telling you, based off of my analysis of the game, they're like, yeah, he's probably going to drop at least 2 touchdowns on the Dolphins. That's like common sense. That's not rocket science, but yeah, it's some people literally only watch sports because they're trying to make money off of it now.
Right. It's going to become more of a fool's play in 2026 when the tax law changes to make it a lot less attractive to wager. So the only advice I'd have, and I'm a person who spent a lot of time essentially as a professional gambler playing blackjack. And I'll say that it's just going to be a hell of a lot harder to make money. I did a podcast earlier this year. If you want to go look at it, it was about making a futures bet on the Ravens. And it came out right after the Trump bill came out, but basically has 100% of your winnings are taxable and only 90% of your losses are deductible. That has an incredible impact on how much more you need to win. And it effectively means the magic number that used to be 52.38% you had to win to break even on a typical 11 to 10 line. It's now 53.88% if you're in a 30% tax bracket. A lot of people are not in, they're in a higher tax bracket than that and have a worse position. But I'll just say, if you want to gamble for fun, go ahead and keep doing it. You want to make a big futures bet to make a killing on the Ravens, I would highly advise against it for a number of reasons that I outlined in that pod.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to the next question. Dirk Schwenk says, how is LJ so efficient? It seems like he has far less attempts and yards, but more touchdowns than is normal. What is the magic sauce?
I mean, he's one of one, man. I mean, it's he's one of those guys where he is the perfect blend of cerebralness and also athleticism. You know, and he's grown so much as a passer and a processor. He was underrated. He was an underrated passer coming out of college. I I'll still stand on that 10 toes down. But the fact that he's come light years since he's been in the league, and then since coming together with Todd Monken, especially, I think his development as a quarterback with Todd Monken and T. Martin has grown leaps and bounds. So, like I said, you get the perfect storm with the guy. He's everything wrapped into one. And when you kind of have that, it's almost like the Keaton Mitchell thing, right? Where you don't need the abundance of opportunities to make the big plays and make your team in advantageous positions to succeed.
Yeah, I think I'd add that he's really got the best set of skill position players that he's had. Hopkins was a big addition this year in terms of a guy who makes him more efficient on a per target basis. How Tez Walker has been used. It's not a lot, but it's been really effective on a per target basis. And it just seems like Lamar is probably able to use more receivers effectively now than he ever has been. And some of it's the players that he has in those extra spots, and some of it is Lamar just having more trust and more people to distribute the ball around. Really, the era where Mark Andrews was the guy who was always his bailout guy was very unhealthy for Lamar and for the Ravens. And while they, you know,
2021,
it was very unhealthy. Yeah. All right, well, we got one more here from Angelo. Also says regarding the offense, do you attribute the slow start to LJ's rustiness? He's talking about the first half in this game. I keep seeing clips about how our interior got zero push against an underperforming front. If so, is running Keaton/healthy Lamar to the edges a way to combat the weak interior? You want to start?
I do attribute a lot of it to Lamar's rustiness. Like I said, you can't, like, no matter how much half walkthrough practices you have in a 7-day span, having 31 days off of action is definitely going to have its effect. You know, you see that. You saw that on the first drive of the game where he short hopped that one to Rashad Bateman, and you saw that once they got him going in the second half, man, it was no holding back. But as far as the Dolphins, like I said, the Dolphins were in a similar position as the Ravens. They're fighting to keep their season alive too. They're fighting for their head coach's job. Now, he didn't end up getting fired. The GM did, but you know, like, you can't take that kind of stuff lightly. Like, these guys are under nationals. Nobody wants to be embarrassed when they step onto the field, especially in a standalone game on a short week at home. So, like, you know, you got an inspired Dolphins defense coming off of a shellacking of the Atlanta Falcons. So they're confident. Ravens coming in there a little, you know, confident with their quarterback back, but he's been off. So as far as the slow start, like I said, attributed to a mixture of Lamar rust, Dolphins playing with some pride, and then
I think you did a very good job with that. The only thing I'd say is about the is running Keaton healthy, Lamar to the edge is the way to combat the weak interior. That should always be part of the offense. And the offense will be better when Lamar is able to truly be the outside threat or the inside threat, the running threat that he can, because the Henry-Lamar mesh point remains the biggest single weapon in the entire NFL right now. Getting Keaton Mitchell is for additional misdirection is great. Using the counters that they did in the Bears game is a good way to create additional misdirection. Anything you can do to get defenders moving, generally speaking, getting them potentially moving themselves out of position is usually a good thing.
Yeah, I really want to see the Ravens really attack the edges with Keaton Mitchell in particular, especially if Lamar is still kind of working on his hamstring thing. If you have somebody that can get to the edge and threaten the edges of defenses, I mean, the way that Keaton can not just get to the edge, but like explode upfield the way he does, I mean, you got to test the edges more than they're doing right now. So I'd like to see that, especially the change of pace, especially if it comes out of the pony backfield. Just like having that kind of element to where you could, you know, any given play, you could get Henry up the middle or keep Mitchell to the edge. That's lethal, man.
Even though this wasn't a big game for Mitchell, I think they're moving in the right direction to get him 10 snaps. And I think he's got a good chance to get more snaps as we move forward. Let's talk MVPs in this game. We usually go 3-2-1. Who's your number three guy?
My number three guy, Todd Monken. Todd Monken. You know, like can we do coaches or
you
or,
can do whatever you want. Okay. There's no money being wagered on this, so you need not worry about it.
Yeah. Todd Monken, man, back-to-back games from him. Just kind of seeing that more creativity, using more of his weapons, getting guys open. Granted, against two compromised secondaries, but you know, like taking full advantage of those compromised secondaries while still staying committed to the run. And that's my whole thing with Todd. Like even when the Ravens have gone against inferior opponents in the past, since he's been at the helm, he's still got a little too pass happy sometimes. And just the seeing his commitment to the run and just knowing that eventually, like, not only does it keep the defense honest, but eventually they start to wilt. I love seeing that from him. And then, like I said, I love seeing some of the passing concepts where you're getting players in position, but they're colliding with each other. Now that's more bad defense than scheme. But like I said, you still got guys kind of streaking wide open in this offense, and I'm loving it right now.
Yeah, we've seen a fair number of times. We've seen it where Lamar, when he's playing NFC teams in particular, there seems to be a lot more chance of a mistake like that occurring. That remember in 2020 when they played the entire NFC East, and again, I think in 2024 as well, but 2020 is when I really remember it. I think he had three long touchdowns, one each against each of those NFC East teams. And they were all
places where
the middle linebacker, you know, basically ran himself out of the play. And so anything you can do to get that started, to make linebackers make missteps, is usually probably a good thing. All right, my number three guys is, I'm cheating also, a pair of players, Tyler Linderbaum and Roger Rosengard, both had outstanding games, so they share it at number three for me. They easily could have been number two, but they were, you know, the Ravens haven't had really any games this year, I don't think, where I've taken an offensive lineman. Well, actually, here's the starting problem. They've only won three games, so I only do MVPs for wins, so there haven't been a lot of opportunities, but Linderbaum and Rosengard very much deserve it as a pairing in this one.
Okay, my number two guy is Kyle Hamilton, man. I mean, that dude is the, he's the.
I'm sorry, these are only offense, but you can.
Oh, my bad. Yeah, okay. All right, let me reset that. As far as offense goes, then I'll give it to Derrick Henry, man. Derrick Henry, just kind of breaking the will of that Dolphins defense in the second half, and really kind of like he's bouncing for the past two games. He's really kind of more willing to bounce things out. If the defense is getting penetration up the middle, he's kind of not hesitating as far as getting it back around the corner and making his own space there and taking advantage of that from the defense. And just to kind of see him do that and just kind of to break the will of the Dolphins defense in the second half, I really like seeing that.
Yeah, we haven't seen him really run away from defensive backs too much this year. Like the 87-yard run, he kind of ran away from the defense versus Buffalo last year. This game, though, was maybe the first time where we've seen a little bit of that juice to the outside where he had one of the long runs. Anyway, it was up the right sideline. The defensive backs were having a hard time catching up. And they did eventually get him out of bounds. But you love to see that with Derek. And
you realize bouncing right. Like every time he's bouncing out to that right side.
That's, to me, that was Willis McGahee's running style all the time. He's a very natural bounce outside guy. As much as he could be a one cut and, you know, head back guy, just really loved to bounce to the outside, and he was effective at it. And it really worked at the goal line. Remember the way he used to search for the hole and on like a always turned a goal line seven offensive lineman play into a stretch play where he would just find the best place, whether it was behind Nada or whoever was on the offensive line for those plays. All right, my number two guy also Derrick Henry, and I just gave some reasons. So let's move on to number one,
Mark Jackson, the man himself, man of the hour, man. It was so good to see him back, and like I said, kind of tail. I wouldn't say tail of two halves, but just like seeing that gradual progression from him, shaking that rust off, and kind of looking like the Lamar Jackson of earlier this year, minus the full mobility. Like I said, he really wasn't trying to test that hamstring too much, but he didn't need to, because he was able to extend time. And really kind of, I mean, there was that one play where he kind of like fought through his, like just kind of shrugged off his sack to still completed the ball. I still have to see him kind of like, be more, I wouldn't say decisive, but like kind of take off sometimes and instead of taking some of those short sacks. And it's like run when he does see green space. That 13-yard pickup that he had where he got the majority of his rushing yards was so huge in this game as far as keeping that drive alive.
And he had two touchdown passes in the first half. It wasn't a terrible half of football or anything, but it was, no. 6 yards per throw was not really exceptional. And then it came out in the second half, and this is more like what we see about Lamar Jackson just so often is that he's absurdly efficient in terms of his completions. And all of a sudden, he's making all of these quote-unquote easy throws. The guy was wide open. What are you talking? Well, no, Lamar got him open by moving him out a little bit. Yeah, and then he made an easy pitch catcher. Yeah, he did. And maybe he caught it in stride on some of these. And there was good yak involved. I mean, a lot of that is Lamar doing the things that are from a processing standpoint, from a extending play standpoint, to make sure that the plays go off as well. And part of me really wants to see Lamar Jackson make 2 to 4 more on schedule throws per game. So it'll be a little bit easier to get first downs and go back to 2019 Ravens football to a little bit greater degree. But part of me says, if you really try and screw up Lamar by saying, don't run around and make plays, yeah. I just think your potential risk is very high that you turn. I actually don't think he'll listen to that sort of coaching. So I don't think it would work. He's perfectly happy coming to the sideline and says, just playing ball, coach. Just playing ball. Yeah, I think so. Anyway, Lamar Jackson, my number one guy too, obviously. Josh, thanks so much for coming on. It was always a pleasure talking football with you. It's always a great couple hours spent when you are able to spend the time on the show. Tell folks where they can find your work.
Yes, you can find all my Ravens related content at Ravens on SI. I'm a full-time sports reporter up here in Anchorage, Alaska, covering any and all things Alaska sports, both far and wide. Whenever somebody from Alaska's in the Olympics or doing something cool in the NFL, got a couple guys in the NFL right now doing some cool things. I'm all over it. So you can always contact me on Twitter at JoshReed907.
All right. By the way, is Saleh anywhere in the league right now? Is he on anybody's practice squad, or is he still hanging around?
Nah, man, I've been keeping track of him. Last time I saw, he had worked out with the Falcons, the Packers, and some other team, I want to say during like the month of August, but he hasn't landed anywhere.
He hasn't hooked on.
I think it'd be smart of him to try to go like UFL route, because there's so many guys that were like kind of NFL cast offs that couldn't really catch on there, get some time. He just needs reps, man. He needs reps and time to develop, and you can do that at that level. So I know a lot of guys kind of turn their nose up at it, but you know, if you really want to get some time on task and get some tape out there without having to get your passport and crossing the border to Canada, there's quality football being played at the UFL with some legitimate NFL players that are going to be in the NFL come next fall.
Yeah, there are a true lack of spots for Americans between the UFL, which is not huge, and the CFL, which is highly anti-American. If you play defensive back or wide receiver, and you're an American, you got a big disadvantage going up there and trying to get on the roster, because they have to have 20 Canadians, you know, and there's rules on the number of starting players too. So like Brent Urban, if he went back to play in Canada, would be a really valuable commodity for some team of you know, being a Canadian who could play. Tavius Robinson, if he went back, would be one of the superstars of the whole league. So anyway, it's a tough league to latch onto. But anyway, really appreciate having you, Josh. Other folks out there, thanks so much for listening. Please make use of hashtag FilmStudyMailbag when you have questions, and it can be for any show, including Friday Morning GM. We have the trade deadline coming up. We have a lot of content coming out this next week, including a couple shorts. Please listen in, and we'll talk to you later on Film Study.